MODO.US.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. MODO offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games with free spins, exciting promotions, and always generous jackpots. You can waste your time with the others, or you can win at MODO. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
MODO is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This week for you, I have a very special guest. We talked a little bit on our follow-up episode, and I'm already seeing tons of reports of lots of binging happening of the Murder 101 podcast. People prepping to hear from Mr. Alex Campbell. He's a teacher at the Elizabethton. Am I saying that right? Elizabethton or Elizabethtown?
It's Elizabethton.
Elizabethton, Tennessee. He's a high school sociology teacher that worked with this class and helped solve a murder, and he's here joining. And he was wondering if we were going to be on video for our patrons. It's on video because he wanted to make sure that he had his hair done. If he was, and I see Mr. Campbell, that you have your hair done perfectly.
Never a hair out of place.
Yeah, that's right. Now, for those of you that are only hearing this on the audio, Alex does have his head completely shaved.
Yes.
And I've been wondering all day since you sent me that email what I was going to be expecting from this hair that you had to get done.
Yeah, well, I said I had a face for podcast, but I also have a voice for TV.
Right.
You have a good broadcasting voice, so I'll see what I can do.
That's what they tell me. I stumbled into it a few years. I was a fireman before. I've had all kinds of career stuff. I was a fireman, started podcasting, and now I'm teaching podcasting and not a fireman anymore. And that's, you know, I want to get in this. When I listen to your show, so this year I just started teaching this high school class. They created a broadcasting CTE course at our high school, and I got convinced to go in and teach it, and I've been loving it, and been trying to find things to do with my students that are, you know, have some real world, you know, consequence. And when I listen to your show, the first question, we'll get into what exactly you guys did and how you did it, but the first question I have for you is, when I was listening to your kids talk on the podcast, they all seem so excited. How do you get all of your students to actually want to do this? That's the thing that Teacher Bob needs to know.
Yeah, to be honest, I think kids want to do exciting things, right?
Yeah.
They love excitement. They love to do things that are fun and interesting and that they're interested in. And what I found out from this generation is they want to feel like that what they're doing makes a difference in the world.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that's what social media has done. Everything you do is seen by all these people.
Right.
And then you do something at school and nobody sees it but you and the teacher, right? And it makes it feel like, you know, does this have meaning, real world impact? So I think they naturally want that. Every great lesson, I think, has to have a good hook. You've got to get them interested.
Yeah.
If you listen to the podcast, you'll know that I challenge them on the first day to see, hey, can we find one person out of 200 million? And they were very intrigued by that. And that really did get them kind of excited to get going.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did you really have like 100% buy-in from the students?
Oh yeah,
that's amazing. I mean that in and of itself is something that your hats should be tipped to you for, because for me when I went into, you know, it's a fun class. I teach, you know, broadcasting, so it's a fun class. Kids are excited to do it, but in every class there's this group over here that is excited about every project and this group over here that doesn't really want to do it. And then the strange thing that shocked me when you're talking about social media is how my students don't want anybody to see their work. Some of them do amazing projects, but they're like, Mr. Ruff, nobody's going to see this, right? You're not going to show it to anybody. Did you deal with any of that, or were they all ready to put this out into the world?
Well, I mean, I think that many of them do, you know, they worry, am I a good speaker?
Yeah.
You know, can I sound good? Is this good work? But what you do as a teacher is, you have that final kind of presentation of work. For us, there were several kind of final presentations of work. But what you do is you bring in experts. What I do is I bring in experts along the way. And for example, we were building the profile.
Yeah.
You know, let the profiler come and work with them. And then they give them feedback. Hey, this is great work. You're doing really good here. What about this?
Mm-hmm.
And then so they get encouragement along the way. And it really kind of builds them up to where they know they're getting the skills that they need. And that, by the way, by the time the final presentation is ready, that they feel, they're still going to feel a little nervous, right? That's
right.
Kind of the point. But they feel like, yeah, I've made it this far. Experts in the field say it's good. I've put in the work. I've put in the practice. And, you know, I feel pretty good about it.
That's awesome. So let's back up for anybody that isn't familiar with the show and explain to them what you did. So first of all, I have one more teaching type question.
Sure.
The one thing that caught my attention was that you teach sociology in a high school. And I don't know if that's a common in Tennessee or how that, because like none of our schools around here have a sociology class at all. So that was fascinating to begin with.
I've worked at this school for about 17 years teaching social studies. And it's always something we've had. The state does have a curriculum for both sociology and psychology. I can't really say how unusual it is, but I mean, I do know the state has the curriculum. And it's always been here. So I did teach psychology years ago at a different school when I was teaching science.
Mm-hmm.
But since I've been doing social studies, I've on and off taught sociology for the last, 17 years, I guess.
That's awesome. And so with that semester, was it the 2017 school year, the beginning when you started?
2018. So it's 2018 spring semester.
Okay.
We're on semester schedule.
Okay. So when you started that class, explain to everybody what you decided to do for your sociology class.
Yeah. Give a little background. The semester before, I had worked with a criminal justice teacher who was just down the hall, and we looked into a local cold case murder, and it had never been officially solved. And it was of a young, white, small, redheaded teenage girl who was killed and thrown out beside the road in Tennessee in the 1980s. And we did look into that case, but as I was just researching, I kept finding things about redhead murders.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that small, white, young, redheaded women killed and thrown out beside the road in Tennessee in the 80s was not anything that was uncommon. So the next semester, he was coaching, I believe it was baseball, and he said, man, I'm going to be really busy. I don't know if I can do a big project like that. So I said, look, we'll just do it on our own. Like, I want to explore this more. And so that's how I came upon the idea of maybe we could look into the redhead murders.
Yeah, and then you took, you know, being a sociology class, what was your first step into it, working on, like, the behavioral analysis and the profiling element of it?
Yes. So what we did first, all we really had was victimology.
Uh-huh.
We had no, you know, files from the police, just what we could find in the newspaper. And so we just looked at all the victims. You know, we used DoeNet and, you know, places like that, and just find as much information as we could on the victims. And then we just learned to use victimology to learn about the victims to tell us about the perpetrator. And so the goal was really to see that there's about 12 to 14 of these murders that are many times classified as the redhead murders. We never thought that all of them were killed by the same person, but the goal was to see if any of them were killed by the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement had never come to any conclusion back in the 80s whether a serial killer was at work or was this 12 to 14 different murders just happening in the same time period with similar victims. So what we wanted to do was just look at all these victims and say, can we find some of these victims that would match to the same suspect? And if so, can we really look and see if there was an active serial killer in our state back in the 1980s?
Okay. Now, did you have any, other than you worked with the criminal justice teacher the semester before, did you have any background in law enforcement or profiling, or how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I blame my wife for most of those things.
Yeah.
I actually wasn't into true crime early on in my life. I'm a history teacher by trade, mm-hmm. and I love history. I love, you know, wars, time periods, and music. I love all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's what I would watch on TV. That's what I read books about. But when I married my wife, she was really into true crime, And I remember buying her Mine Hunters one year for her birthday. But we started watching, you know, Dateline, you know, 48 Hours, things like that. We'd have a date night, just kind of sit around the house. And that's something we would watch together. And I did get interested in it that way. And then when I was started teaching psychology, one of the things I did at the end of the year, now, if you know anything about teaching, especially in high school, after those state tests, you know, you have like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And the students sometimes tend to think, oh, well, you know, summer's almost here. I took this big test, like, you know, school's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a guy encourage me one time. He said, save your best lessons for the last part of the year.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, let's do that. What is the best part of psychology? To me, it was looking at serial killers, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought the kids would find that interesting. Let's see what we can learn about that from psychology. When I began to teach sociology, I did the same thing. I saved that unit to the end. And, you know, the students were really responding to it. So really is just my own digging around with it. But I had no formal training in any of those things.
And so once you started going, I guess let me back up. So you had no formal training other than watching the 48 hours and all that stuff. What resources did you get? Because, and I just know for me, like this class I'm teaching now, they created it this year and they're like, oh, you're a broadcaster. You can teach broadcasting. And then I'm like, do you have a curriculum? They're like, no, you make the curriculum. So like what, how did you develop your lesson plans to even teach this stuff without having the background in it?
Yeah, I'll say that I'm kind of a weird teacher. I think if you ask around, people would probably say that about me. But I can't use other people's stuff. I never have. I find lessons and sometimes I might take it and like just adapt it. You know, I just can't. Some people just go online, find something and say, oh, that'd be great. I can use it. But I'm just weird like that. So I'm really used to kind of creating my own curriculum. And so what I do when I plan something like this project is I look at the final product. Okay. The final product will have something to do with seeing if, one or more of these murders are related to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, well, what skills would that take? And then I say, what knowledges would that require from my curriculum? And that's how I kind of plan it out. So, you know, for example, the first thing we did was we began to read and research on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to take certain skills.
Yeah.
And then are there any, you know, standards that would fit in well with that? So we're going to look at their family. Like, where do these women come from? Why haven't they been identified for 30 years? What kind of families would they come from? What kind of families would have someone go missing and they don't get reported to police? And so we started, you know, I'm just thinking, like, where are these standards going to appear
right
in the different, where I call them deliverables, people call them different things. But each stage of the project, there's something that you have to do for me.
Mm.
And so where do these standards fit with those deliverables? That's kind of the way I kind of reverse engineer it.
That's you and I are two peas in the same pod in the classroom, I think, because that's kind of the same. What you just described has been my whole first year teaching at the high school. I've taught in the college. When I was a fireman, I taught fire science for years and had to develop my own curriculums. But it's kind of that same thing. This is what I want to do. Now, how do I make it fit into the deliverables I need to do? And how can I put certain elements in there? That it's just fascinating. And you're obviously a teacher the kids really like, because they to get that kind of buy-in is, I mean, I think people that haven't taught in a high school don't realize that even something that you think sounds cool, it's not always that easy to get kids to get it. Because we've done some really cool projects, and sometimes it's like I got to kind of drag them in and get them excited about it. And you presented this in a way that they dove in. So when they started working on it, what happened from there?
Well, the students felt that six victims were very, very similar. And so we really needed some help. We needed someone who was an expert in criminal profiling. And so I only knew one person in the FBI. He was a former student's dad. And so I called him up and said, hey, please tell me you could help me find a profiler, behavior analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're not going to believe it. Best friend from high school, also went into the bureau. I could give you a cell phone number right now. So we talked, and he was working in our state, but he was about 3.5 hours away. But he said, yeah, I'd love to help. And, you know, I travel around some. Next time I'm coming up that way, you know, I'll stop and work with your students. I was just hoping for like a Zoom call, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But But he said, no, I'll come all the way up there and we'll work it out. So he came and taught the students, how do you profile? You know, how do you analyze behaviors? What do we need to look for to see if there's actually one person who killed these six women? So he helped me teach the students. And so that's where we went from there.
And then from there, you had the kids develop a profile. And it sounded like, was it in depth? Or was it the number 63 sticking in my head? It was 63 page profile. Was that right? Or
so it was a little large.
I'm trying to remember the podcast. I remember when they explained it that I was like, wow, that's a big long profile, however long it was.
Yeah, I think it was about 7 pages.
Okay.
And I don't know, like 17 or 18, 20 something, you know, around 20 characteristics.
Yeah.
And so really, I think the reason we tried to do that was we saw in some of the old newspaper articles that there had been a profile developed for one of the murders. There had only been one of the six women who had been identified. Mm-hmm. Her name was Lisa Nichols. She was killed in West Memphis, Arkansas. And so they actually asked the Memphis department of the FBI there to create a profile. We actually found the person's name who was asked to create it. The problem is the West Memphis, Arkansas, Crittenden County had the murder. They didn't have it. The TBI didn't have it. And the FBI didn't have it. So if one was created, it was lost. So the student said, hey, can we recreate this law enforcement tool? And I was like, hey, that sounds like a great idea. So, you know, we used our FBI behavior analyst to help us with that. Then each group had different parts that they did. And then we put it all together and we presented that back to the FBI behavior analyst and he helped me grade it. And he said it was excellent work. He would not disagree with any conclusion that they had come to.
That's amazing. And that had to make the kids had to be over the moon when they heard that.
Yeah, they were pretty excited. Of course, I played that up too. You know, yeah. It took me like 2 days to send it. I'm like, are you sure this is ready to send? Because he's going to tear this thing up, you know. And they're like, okay, let us look at it one more time, you know. And so eventually they, you know, we sent it and they're like, we're ready, Mr. Campbell. And then when he sent it back, I'm like, are you ready to see the email? I had it up on the board. I mean, what if he says this is terrible? Are you going to cry? You know, can you handle this? And they're like, just show us the email. And of course, they loved it. They said, they were just really proud of themselves, I think. And they had a lot to be proud of. He had been a good teacher. I don't think we could have found anybody better to work with the students. But they had also listened to what he said and worked very hard to find the information and put it together.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games with free spins, exciting promotions, and always generous jackpots. You can waste your time with the others, or you can win at Modo. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
And in the profile, some basic elements of it, they determined that it was probably an over-the-road truck driver.
You know, so we took some flack because, in the paper, they just presented like, you know, kind of the basics.
Yeah.
You know, he's between 30 and 50 or something. They're like, well, yeah. That's like half the population. And that's true. The weight was between, you know, this and this. And, but, you know, they did overland trucker, which I think a lot of people felt that he was. But they really hit it on a lot of other things. Of course, we wouldn't know that until we had a suspect, and we wouldn't know most of that until we actually got to hear an interview with his ex-wife. So, and the more information we find, just the more it confirms. By the way, after there was a person in prison for trying to kill one of these women, and then later in 2019, they announced that his DNA was found on one of these six. And every single thing the students had predicted was 100% accurate, including things like why he kills, will he have family, will he have a wife, will he have children, what's his family's history, alcoholism, you know, prison time. Like, they got all those things right.
Yeah, so they nailed this profile. And then where do you – because I didn't realize – when I first started listening to the podcast, I was thinking, I know this case. Why do I know this case? And then I hear Shane Waters on the show. So, and it's because, you know, Shane's a friend of mine And
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And I had interviewed him on one of my other shows a couple of years ago. And so I went back and listened to that, and I'm like, that's what it is. He was working on the same case you guys were. So how did you guys end up connecting?
So Shane is awesome. He is amazing. His heart for victims and, you know, justice for victims is amazing. And so he had began to look at this, you know, before we had, maybe a few months before. And so one of the things that the students did was they had to research all the things that they could find online. And one of the students said, Mr. Campbell, do you know there's a Redhead Murders Facebook page that was just created like a month ago? And I said, hey, like, does he have a contact? I'll call him. So I contacted him through Facebook. We had a talk. I believe I was out of town in West Virginia, but I was like, man, I want to talk to this guy. And we talked for a while. And, you know, there really wasn't anybody working on this case. There hadn't been any movement on the case in over 30 years. And so he was just very passionate about it. My students were passionate about it. We worked together. He came down. He covered the kids. He allowed them to speak on his podcast and actually read the profile. And so he really helped, you know, amplify the voice of the students. He actually came down for our press conference and spoke. And so he's awesome. Shane is amazing.
Yeah, he's great. And for those of you that are listening that don't know, so Shane's podcast is called Foul Play, and he did the season on the Redhead podcast. And it was, like I said, it was flashback when I was listening to it, and when he was talking about how he had worked with some students in a class and this and that. And and the fact that he drove, because he lives in Indiana, not too far from me, a couple hours away. But the fact that he drove down there to help you guys out doesn't shock me one bit when it comes to, he wants, and I say he's a friend, he's an internet friend that I've met in person a few times at certain events. In a couple of years ago, or last year, I had put up a post. I was looking, my kid bent the rim on his car, and I was like, hey, does anybody know anybody, thinking locally, that has a rim off one of these or a spare I could buy? And Shane calls me and says, I've got one. You're only 2.5 hours away. I'll drive up there. And I didn't let him make the drive, but that's just the kind of guy he is, that he's like, if he can help somebody, he's going to help him.
Absolutely. I think he's been down here 3 or 4 different times. He's probably 400 miles away. But he's just a great guy. And, you know, he just had a passion. A lot of people, when it's all Jane Doe's, there's just not a lot of information, a lot of dead ends, especially when it appears that a lot of them were low socioeconomic, you know, fractured families. People just say, look, there's just not going to be anything happen with this. And a lot of people, you know, get scared off from those things. But he didn't, you know, he wanted to focus on that. And because of hard work from him and, you know, the police have been involved, you know, and the students getting the word out there. I just can't believe all the things that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. So let's kind of walk through that. So this was a one semester project. And then the semester they deliver the profile, it gets on. So when do you start seeing movement on it? And what do you do with your subsequent classes after that?
So the class ended up in May of 2018. And then sometime that fall, the TBI announced that they had identified the first Redhead Murders victim in over, like, you know, almost 35 years or something. Uh-huh. And it was what was used to be called the Campbell County Jane Doe. Her name was Tina Farmer. And so that was the first thing that happened. We were actually waiting on DNA from another case. We had been talking with a lady who felt that it was her mother. And so we actually expected that DNA to come back first because it had been a year and a half or 2 years, but it was just really slow. And so actually, so the Tina Farmer case happens. And then right after that, you have the, she was referred to as the Knox County, Kentucky Jane Doe, SB Pilgrim, ended up being, that's who she was. And we actually found out after more information comes out that she wasn't related to our case, but that came out. And then the following year, they actually said that they knew who had killed Tina Farmer, and that was Jerry Johns. So, like, there was people being identified and even cases being, one case being closed. And then now, as of like a month ago, all of these victims that we feel are tied to the same person have now been identified.
That's amazing. And it can't be stressed enough, the power of just the exposure from what you guys are doing. Because, you know, these cases, and oftentimes, and it sounds like, at least, I don't know if that's gotten any better since then, but that, it's oftentimes the case that law enforcement wants to not give credit where credit is due because they feel, I don't know if they feel like it makes them look bad or whatever. I remember hearing about the press conference where they didn't invite you guys. But the reality is, no one was talking about this case. No one was investigating this case until you guys started doing it. That put it back in the media's or in the law enforcement's mind again, and it got them working on the case again. And now it's, people are getting some, at least some closure, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's what the students wanted. We did have that talk, like, what do you want out of this? I think the first day they thought we're going to have a guy in cuffs by the end of the semester.
Yeah.
And that's probably not going to happen. We talked a lot about cold cases, why they're cold, limited resources, those type of things.
Yeah.
But they said, hey, we can bring attention to these cases. What they found is that, many of these women came from difficult home lives. And if they don't have close families that were advocating for them, then the students wanted to be that family. Shane Waters wanted to be that family. Hey, let's get the story out. Let's remind people about what's going on. And they're never going to solve it if nobody's ever heard of the Redhead murders.
Right.
I have lived in Tennessee my entire life. I'm 45 years old. I would have been, maybe 10 years old, maybe at the time, almost 10 years old at the time of the last murders. Never, ever heard of the Redhead murders my entire life. Never heard that there could have been a serial killer operating, right here in our state. So, if I've never heard about it and I've lived here my whole life, who else has heard about it? And the answer is nobody.
Right.
My dad, he lived here and he's really into news, read the newspaper every morning with his coffee, the kind. And he was like, never heard of it. And so we said, look, we have to get this out in the media. We have to help law enforcement get some tips. And that's exactly what happened. That's how Tina Farmer was identified. Shane, had his podcast. He had the students on there. They're talking about it. And we're going through the victims. Shane and I pretty much had the same six victims. We changed a little bit now that more information has come out. But, he's showing these victims and he's talking about who they are. And a lady was listening to his podcast. She's also looking at missing persons blogs. And so she says, look, the victim you found sounds a lot like this girl who went missing. She sends Shane the tip. Shane shares that with law enforcement. Bam, she's identified within a month. So that's the power. Look, students aren't knocking on doors. They aren't arresting people. They aren't testing the DNA. But they have the ability to use social media, which students are very good at.
Yeah.
And to do lots of man hours worth of work. I mean, I've got 25 kids with 90 minutes a day. That's a lot of work that cops could never do. They just don't have that kind of time. And so that's what they wanted. And that's exactly what happened. And that's exactly what helped in several of these cases.
Yeah. And that's such a big thing with these cold cases. Like you said, I work on wrongful conviction cases, so by definition, they're closed cases already, which gives me access to all the police files and all this stuff. A lot of times I've always kind of shied away from diving into cold cases because, you can't get access to those documents. You can't get access to a lot of things. And if it's cold, that means that the police officers who have subpoena power and warrant power, all that stuff, they couldn't figure it out. So what am I going to do? And then I'm seeing, as you guys, you saw it, you foresaw it, that the big difference is that in 1985, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was no TikTok, there was no Instagram. And it's a game changer, especially like this, where you're trying to identify people. How in 1985, when you have a Jane Doe, do you put something out across all these multiple states to find the person who's missing this victim that you found? There's just not a great way to do it. You might get a blurb in a newspaper or 30 seconds on the news and that's it. But now it can get blasted everywhere and it makes huge changes in these cases.
Yes, absolutely. So that's, I think the kids were smart that they keyed on that. And you're right. These ways to get information out is big. And so, podcasts like yours, I think sometimes people feel like, I'm just a speck out here. But really, the crowdsourcing of police work in a way or detective work, it's been one of the amazing things that's come along with the internet.
Yeah. And my whole podcast kind of started by accident, just from a hobby when I didn't even know what it was when I started. It kind of morphed into what it is today. But what we figured out as a collective group with me and this whole audience is even though we're not cops or lawyers or investigators or whatever, having 100,000 people all looking at the same thing from different perspectives and different walks of life with different skill sets is it's massive, the amount, the difference that it can make, and how you can spot things that were missed. You know, when you got one detective that's working five cases at a time, trying to put their time into it, they're not going to catch everything. But if you get, if you put out five crime scene photos and give 100,000 people a week to look at them, they're going to find whatever it was that got missed by everybody else. And so many times we've seen where things that my listeners have caught things that have been missed by investigators for 10, 15, 20 years because they just didn't have that the time and the different perspectives on it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my students, I think we got away from one of the questions you had, which was, you know, what happened next?
Yeah.
And the answer is, like, we didn't know what was going to happen next. So actually the next semester, next year, school year, we had a different project. And that was try to help a lady get out of prison who was serving 25 to life. And the students helped get her out of prison. So that was pretty amazing too.
Really?
And, yeah. So that was fascinating. That was awesome. That was mind blowing as well. It's Suzanne Johnson case out of California. But, so that was really cool. And then actually the next year, I was put in a different role, kind of a little bit more administrative role. I didn't have any classes that year.
Uh-huh.
And then I slowly kind of worked back into one class, two class. And so actually this year was my first year of having a full class load again, which means I had time for that elective. And so uh-huh. this year we had, I had sociology again. Of course, we did some work on the Redhead murders. And then actually I had two students who worked last year with me. And they did the work on their own time. We actually met outside of school hours, and they did some great work too. So, you know, we gave it a couple of years rest, not intentionally, just kind of the way it worked out. And that allowed a lot of things to happen. And so the reason that the students needed to work on it again was because so much information had come out with each new identification. A lot more information comes out. And we really have to go back through and say, do these women still look like they're tied to the same suspect? Do we need to exclude? We actually ended up excluding two and including a new two because we learned a lot more about them once they were identified. So there's been some of that work done. The students this past semester in December presented to the Greene County Assistant District Attorney. They have one of the murders. They're the closest one to us. Now she's younger. She wasn't alive back then. Uh-huh. She said, I've never heard of this case. Didn't even know it existed. And that's the point. Like, if she doesn't know it exists, they're never going to do anything with it. At least now they know there is this case, and they actually know there's a lot of, you can call it data, you could call it information, you could call it evidence that shows that we have a pretty good idea who probably killed her.
That's incredible. And do you plan to keep on going? Like, once you have exhausted this case, to move on to another case and just keep this going as a project that the students are going to keep doing?
Well, yeah, I'm open to lots of different projects. Like I said, you know, the next semester we did something a little different, but it seems like there's so much work to be done in these cases. You know, we had a lady identified just before school started in August, maybe July, she was discovered. And then we had another one discovered about a month ago. I figured out who she was. And, you know, you speak to their family members, you begin to look up, you know, police records and more information. And there's just so much stuff to go through. And really, every time you do that, you have to go back through all the information and say, does she fit with the profile? And if she doesn't, then you know what? Maybe we need to move her out. But if she does, we need to keep working on this. And so, look, I'm getting old. You can see the white in my beard. I don't know how many more years I have left, but it feels like there's enough work to keep us busy for a while on just this case. But, I mean, my students do a lot of different projects. I teach world history, U.S. history, other things too. I am a project-based learning teacher. We always learn through projects.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always looking for interesting things. So, you know, who knows?
Maybe in the future there could be a collab between this little Michigan broadcasting class in this Tennessee sociology class to put together a project. I can see it. I can see it, Alex, in my head.
What are we waiting on?
Right.
it should have happened already, right?
Right, right. Well, hey, I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to ask. So This all happened. I thought when I first was told about the podcast that this was like your class putting together, making a podcast about this. And that's not the case. You guys did all the work, the investigative work. And then this team from iHeartMedia comes in, which I know when I heard all the names at the beginning of the people that produce them, like I know all of them too. I interviewed them all about the Piketon Massacre podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So how did that come to be? And then how did that go when you had to present that? Because you work for a school, you got to present that to your administration that, hey, we want to put this out on this national worldwide podcast.
Yeah. You know, several different media outlets had contacted us over the years, contacted Shane over the years.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, it just never worked out for whatever reason. You know, you think about your normal true crime kind of series, you know, you got 42 minutes to try to present
right.
a case. I've just got to be honest. This case is so complicated. You've got 40 years, you've got 14 women, you've got probably six that are related. It's taken place over 3-4 states. There's a lot in there. And I don't think you could really do justice to it in 40 minutes. But, you know, the long form podcast, I think, really changed everything. And so we were approached by KT Studios. And of course, like you said, they had a huge hit with the Piketon Massacre. And they were looking for other interesting stories and just came across this one. One thing I like is there's lots of true crime podcasts. I listen to a lot of them. I like them. One of the things they said was this one's different. Like, students are doing the work. Like,
yeah.
Can we talk about the school aspect of it too? And me being a teacher, I said, yes, let's do that. So I liked their vision. Also said, look, we're going to be victim forward. We're not going to make a slasher flick here. Yeah. We're going to treat them with dignity, you know? And they were like, yes, education, victim forward, treat them with dignity. You know, let's see what we can do. So again, like they're just amplifying the voice of the students. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they did a great job. They did a great job with it. So I tell some of my friends, and I think they expect like some kids in the library, like ruffling some papers or something. But, you know, it is a professionally produced, you know, story. You give away a little bit of creative control, but like they did such a good job producing that and turning that into a quality thing that people could really enjoy and learn more about education, which I'm excited about, and the good work that our young people can do. But also all those victims, you know, portraying them as real women with families and trying to get justice for them. And, you know, hey, people hear the podcast and they call me. I have gotten so many leads on this case from people because they heard the podcast.
Absolutely.
So I have more information to go through because of the podcast. So it just continues. I was talking to a guy in Canada, the CBC, a couple of weeks ago. And I said, think about this. You had never heard of the Redhead Murders. And now here you are talking to me and I'm talking to you and people in Canada are hearing about these victims. And I said, that's exactly what the students wanted, was to spread this story, let people hear about it, bring law enforcement some new tips, some new ideas, maybe put a little pressure. Like, that's not degrading. I'm a school teacher. If some student comes to me and asks me 10 questions, like, I'm going to pay attention. If a parent calls me 10 times, I'm going to pay attention. It's just human nature. You only have so many resources. So, hey, let's just keep that out there and keep those people calling and asking, and let's maybe get them a few more resources than normally somebody maybe in their standing would receive.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
Whoa, John, what are you playing?
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Moto Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
So it's been now, 5 years, 6 years since that original class did this work. So that's enough time for anyone that if they went to college, they're in and out. Did any of the students that were in that original class, have they gone on, or any of your students throughout the years of doing this, have they gone on to work in law enforcement or even broadcasting or anything like that?
No, they haven't. And I'm not disappointed by that. What I always tell people, students about my class, is I don't expect you to leave here and become a sociologist. I don't expect you to leave here and want to become a historian.
Right.
I don't think math teachers think everybody's going to become a mathematician. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that every teacher should be teaching the same things. And these are many times called 21st century skills, right? How to research,
right.
How to speak, how to advocate, how to be creative, how to solve problems, how to divide things into smaller pieces that you can achieve and finally do this thing. So I think we all should be teaching that. It's just that I wrap mine around the social studies. Mm-hmm. Maybe the English teacher wraps hers around language arts or whatever. And so I hope that the students have taken with them, no matter what they went into, that, you know, they can find a wrong in the world. They can work hard to find what they need to take that on, that they can be compassionate and have empathy for others, and that they can do things to help people. And if that's what they take from my class, I don't care if they're criminal justice or, you know, English or history or whatever it is. I know that they're going to be a better human being. They're going to be a better citizen. They're going to be a better, you know, person. They're going to be a better family member, and they can do their jobs better no matter what they are. So that's the things that I see the kids taking from it. And I see them making their lives better and the lives of people around them better because of the things they learn in this class.
That's great. I said at the beginning, I'll say it again. I think you and I are two peas in the same pod. That's it. I literally just Monday this week had a conversation with my principal about, he was, you know, it's a new class and he was asking how things are going. And when he had popped in, you know, I was sitting off on a desk with some students working on a computer, and there was kids gathered around me and some on my desk. It doesn't look much like a classroom a lot of times. Look, I don't expect that all these students, these 40 kids that I have, that are all going to go out and go work in broadcasting, but I want to send them out with something that they learn compassion, that they learn about, you know, doing something they can be proud of, and all these different skills that you're talking about. And so I think it's awesome that you have that mindset. Sounds like your school corporation kind of has that mindset too, that these are important things.
I mean, let's just think about your school experience. Sitting in a row, you know, a desk in a row, being quiet, copying down what somebody said usually wasn't very interesting.
Right.
To be honest, you probably didn't learn very much from it. You didn't take very much from it.
Mm-hmm.
So like saying, oh, they're not in rows and they're not quiet and they're not just copying down something somebody else said. Thank you for the greatest compliment you could ever give me.
Yeah.
That tells me that, I mean, go somewhere where real work is being done.
Yep.
Like I want it to look like that.
Yeah.
You know, I want it to look like, you know, Google. I want it to look like some cutting edge business where people are solving problems and coming together and collaborating. You know, in school, we call it cheating. In work, they call it collaboration.
Yeah, exactly.
So like that's what I want. And, you know, when I look back and I'm not standing at the front and I'm being quiet and boy, so I can talk. But yeah. When I'm being quiet and I'm watching them do the work, figure it out, like I feel like the best teacher. The less work I do, the better teacher I feel like I am. I did my work beforehand. I put together the learning experience. I brought together experts who are working with them. I found a cool way to like really get them excited about it. You know, I did my work beforehand.
Yeah.
And I let the students do the work in the class. It's like the gym. Whoever's doing the most work in the gym is going to get the most benefit.
Right.
Teachers sit up there and they talk and they sweat and they yell and they run around, and we leave the end of the day and we're exhausted and the kids are full of energy running outside, can't wait to do something else. Like it needs to be the other way around. I need to sit down and let them work hard, sweat, you know, yell, fight, struggle. And then when they leave, they should feel exhausted because they've done so much good work. You know, that's what I want for them. But, you know, you're talking about administration, and the interesting part is all of the students have graduated that were in that original class.
Uh-huh.
They're all over 18. They all can sign their own agreements. It really didn't have anything to do with the school per se. It's a little different with the next group. They were working on their own time.
Uh-huh.
And so that was kind of outside the school as well. Now, this past semester, you know, we had students who were working and, you know, we recorded some things. I'm not sure what's going to come of that. There has been a lot of new information. We would like to keep putting information out. Just spoke with a victim's brother about 2 weeks ago. And I said, look, I just want to hear the story about who she was as a human being. Like, I've got all the victim stuff down here, but like, that's not what we want to focus on. Yes, that's important. You know, maybe that can help us figure out who killed her or what. But like, You know, the police don't have a record of who she was as a human being. Can you just help me with that? You know, that story needs to be told too.
Yeah.
It's like we talked about, it's almost like the victims get frozen in time. Many of these victims were living the worst part of their life. That could have been addiction. They were on the road. They're estranged from their family. You know, different things were happening. And because they were killed, like, there'll always be the drug addict, the prostitute, you know, the runaway that right. got killed. They never have a chance to overcome that and become maybe what they could have been in life. And it's not really fair. That's probably the worst thing that the killer does, is he takes away that ability to live a better life, to change. The great thing about the podcast is that we did get to interview the only surviving victim that we know of, mm-hmm. of the Bible Belt Strangler. And her story is amazing. The person she has become. She's a friend of mine now. You know, she's a grandparent. She's a volunteer. She helps Christian organizations. She does these amazing things. But if she would have been killed, that it's not how she would have been remembered. You know, she'd have been remembered as the exotic dancer that made a bad choice or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, helping to tell those stories, we have more stories to tell. I did plead with everybody at the end of the podcast, if you can help us tell that story, to let us know. But I enjoy telling those stories about human beings. And when people listen to the podcast that I know, they talk to me and they say, man, I loved hearing her story.
Yeah.
I loved hearing that story. And that sometimes, look, like I said, we're not the cops, okay?
Yeah.
We're not going to arrest anybody. What can we do? We can track down these people. We can tell their story. That's the part that hasn't been told yet. So I feel like we still have a lot of work left to do.
Well, I think it's amazing what you're doing. Your students and your whole municipality there is lucky to have you. I mean, everything from your style of teaching and the good work you're doing in this case, and I'm sure more to come. And with that, I think I'm going to let you go for now. But any updates in the case and stuff, I may circle back to you because I'm hooked now. I'm into every one of those episodes, and now I've got your email address. We're going to connect and have some more conversations about, because, you know, for me, is even beyond, you know, the true crime aspect of it, just as a new high school teacher, like, just hearing you talk about what you're doing, I mean, that's stuff that's very useful to me to learn as I go through my career and doing this and making sure that I have a positive impact on the students. So thank you for what you've done in this case and with your students, and appreciate your time coming on.
Yeah, if I can just end with one thing, I was talking to an educator the other day, and he said, you know, he's not a teacher anymore. Now he works with an educational nonprofit, but we kind of met, and he said, you know, I felt like I needed to listen to the podcast, but I wasn't really excited because I'm not a big true crime fan. He said the first three episodes, although there was some true crime, he said it was really about education. It's about our youth. It's about school. It's about what young people can do when you trust them with real work. And I hope that comes through. I hope people say, you know what? Kids can do more than copy down notes. Kids can do more than do bold words out of the end of the book. Kids can do more than chapter review questions. And I think that's why kids get excited. Not because I'm the greatest teacher in the world, but if I am a good teacher, it's because I shut up more and I let the kids do more. I trust them with real work. And what I found since I've been teaching this way is my students have never let me down. And I hope that parents demand more from their schools. I hope the students demand more from their teachers. I hope teachers demand more from themselves. And instead of just telling young people to sit down and shut up, and maybe one day you'll use this, let's just turn them loose on some of our world's problems. I think most people would say we have no shortage of problems in the world. Well, instead of telling kids maybe one day you can help, let's let them do it now. So I hope people enjoy the true crime aspect of it. I hope people enjoy that part too. And maybe we could make some inroads in education where every kid could feel fulfilled in their work.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod. where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kaywood Yomnick, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
It's time to play big on Moto Social Casino, America's hottest free-to-play social casino experience. Moto.us has live casino games. It's time! Play big, win bigger on Moto.us today.
Moto is a social casino, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit Moto.us for more details.
It's time!